Hello, good morning, welcome. I am Samuel Trapp. This is Civic Outlaws. Happy Friday to you. And to me, just because I think I'm going to give myself a happy Friday. How do you like that? Sometimes you just gotta do it. So I want to... Man, my transcript's not working right. I got some music for you, and we're gonna play some old, like a real oldie. We've had a real set of discussions about Idaho. It was kind of interesting how that occurred, and which we discussed the other night when I was in here and did my show at nighttime, so I could put it on yesterday because I had to go to the doctor in the morning and I wasn't available, and so I didn't want to mess that up, and so I did my show early yesterday. If you feel like calling in discussing Idaho or anything else, that's totally fine. 573-746-8020. I may even listen. And so I'm actually there's so many things that happened as far as Civic Outlaws, interesting content. And I want to start with the fact that I am a director of a charity called Civic Outlaws, and I do this show on behalf of Civic Outlaws. And I'm also a director, co-director, whatever you want to call it, of MOLAG, Missouri Licensing Advocacy Group. And that group has the lawsuit filed in Cole County, Missouri. And that suit, there's a hearing on it next week. There's some stuff coming up. It'll be rather entertaining, if nothing else, because it's kind of odd to me. Well, it's not odd to me. I get it. You know, I've been attacked in this way for forever. And it's pretty funny because if that's the only response you got is to turn away from the issue and attack me personally, that's exactly what you accuse me of, is attacking the AG on a personal level. I'm not doing that. I don't even know her. And I question her motives, but that's what people do. She's the one with all the power, not me. And she can create opinions that destroy people's lives. Mine don't, you know, except my own, because I get people targeting me in positions of power. And that's the part that drives me nuts, is the continual justification of destroying people. You know, I have no problem with who I am. And I have no problem with who you've, attacked for years. I have no problem with it. It happened under who was the first? Under Jay Nixon, for some reason. They targeted me all the time. They and okay, you can state that I'm a bad person, basically. But that's that's the whole point. Is people in positions of power get to determine who the bad people are, and you're a good person just because you happen to hold all the power? That's not how it works. You know, there are a lot of bad people in positions they shouldn't be in. And I don't know that she's a good person, bad person. I don't really care. I just think that she's abusing her authority and stretching it to places where it doesn't need to go. I think the same thing is happening in the ATC. I think they haven't been granted that authority by the legislature. These things are not cut and dry. If they were cut and dry, we wouldn't have to wait for some federal judge to declare some sort. The judge himself said it was a mess in Missouri. The torch litigation over there, talking about how messed up Missouri is. Missouri hasn't come up with a ruling, so I guess I'm going to. But he only did it for specific machines, not all. And that's the funny part. And so the taking of that and stretching it is the part that I disagree. This expanding your governmental power at any cost. To other people, of course, never to yourself, You know, you can destroy the lives of other people. You can destroy the financial lives of people. And that's nothing to you. Of course, that's not a problem. And I assume it shouldn't be or wouldn't be. But there are people that act bad in government everywhere. And I want to talk about some of that. These are some new ones that have come up, right? There's a couple of stories that, you know, I want to talk about. And I want to begin with a basic rule. The response to personal attacks is not another personal attack. The response should be a standard, because when a government official judges a citizen, regulates or judges a business, takes or suspends or activates someone's license, removes elected officials on their own whim or their own power grab, search databases without authority, prosecute cases on a targeting sort of basis, use force, then government has to submit to the same requirements it demands of everybody else. And they never do. That's the part I don't like. Evidence, a neutral procedure, not a, I hate Sam Trapp, therefore I'm going to target him, which is what happened to me. You know, any person could be subject to destruction by the government, anyone. I'm one. Now they're targeting all these other people, calling them criminals. They've been operating legally, above board, all the time, for many years. No, but they've been trying. You know, Torch, God love them, tried to get some kind of something done, and they were in the wrong posture to do so. You know, if there was any kind of neutral procedure, which there isn't, the prosecutors get to pick and choose who they attack. And Hanaway has decided who she's going to attack based on her opinion, right? She gets to make some crazy opinion following a judge's ruling on different machines and then attack a third set of machines, but she doesn't attack the set of machines that she ought to be attacking. Oh, no, those can stay. Oh, no, those can operate in charitable halls. They can, you know, they can do all that stuff. But, you know, I get to pick and choose. You know, it's illegal, but only in places that aren't charities. I can't have charities, you know, against me. It's nuts. And so, you know, what about public records, audit trails, written reasons and consequences, and not hiding behind further attacks? But that's what they do. It's always, you can watch it. I mean, like I said, and I've said before, Trump made it okay to question the motives of a-holes in power at the government. They use the apparatus of the state to target political or opinion-based enemies. In my case, I'm just some small media guy. I'm nobody. Haven't been anybody for a long time. Wasn't even anybody then. You know, but that guy just wanted to prove a point that you got to lick the butt of power in Missouri at the OCDC or he will destroy you. And that's what they do. That's how it works. And the Supreme Court of Missouri won't fix it. They won't do it. They won't even listen to fixing it. Why? Because they get appointed by the same corrupt sort of process. That's how Supreme Court justices get picked, you know. I'm not saying that they're corrupt. No. But the process sure as hell is. You know, the process and how it works. The people have no say in how a judge gets picked to the appellate or Supreme Courts in the state of Missouri. That's crap. And I don't like it, never have liked it. I've been against it since I first heard about it. So, boy, that sounds like quite the scam. And it is. But the thing is, nobody knows anything about it because nobody pays any attention to it. And every time something comes up on the ballot and people go, oh, geez, no, that's the... And they have to refer it just like you have to refer to the war in Ukraine as Putin's unprovoked aggression into the free country of Ukraine. You can't just say there's a war in Ukraine where disputing people have disputing testimonies. You've got to say the narrative along with it. And it's the exact same thing with when you talk about this non-judicial or I'm sorry, nonpartisan judicial selection process in Missouri. Nonpartisan my ass. It is not. It is not nonpartisan remotely. Three guys, highly connected guys in the Missouri bar, selected by the Board of Governors of the Missouri bar. The hell is that? who has authority to go in there? And then three citizens, somehow selected by the governor. But who do you think's in charge in that room? It sure as hell ain't the three people selected by the governor. And they have the job of providing. And oh, by the way, number seven would be the Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court. Well, that makes sense. So he gets to pick, or she get to pick and choose who the next, maybe who the next one is. There's no sort of group effort there. That person got appointed by the same process and then wants to have his say in who gets next. So you're telling me that being connected to those four people somehow isn't going to improve your chances of getting appointed to one of these spots? Of course it is. And then the three guys with the governor, they're already on the defensive because they have no say at all, at least in a standard process where the governor picks someone. He picks a candidate, then asks for a senatorial confirmation. At least there's a process. And this one, oh no, we're going to pick three candidates for you, and you must pick one. So the job of the three people that are appointed by the governor is to hopefully get somebody in that the governor would like and have something that is not total devastation and control by the Missouri bar. And that's our process. It doesn't, and nobody ever talks about it. I think the judicial, and then to cement it in for forever, they turned it into a constitutional amendment to have this process. Why? Because allegedly there was mafia influence in St. Louis and Kansas City in the 30s and 40s. So that means you have to create this other process because it's nonpartisan, right? I could, no matter how you slice it, that you could agree with it. You still can't claim that it's nonpartisan. I suppose it doesn't matter who the people are that get appointed. The three that get appointed by the governor would be part of a party if they're Democrats, and everybody in the Missouri bar, the four are in the Missouri bar Democrats, then I guess you got a problem. Even if the Republican, the governor is Republican, so I suppose you could have that problem. But you know, there's no real rhyme or reason to how that works. It's just nonsense. And that's the process that they use. But they never tell you about it because they don't want you to know about it. All they want to do is keep it in place that way on the judicial column of the three-party system. They have no oversight except budgetary. And so what? You're going to withhold their money and make sure that the clerk or nobody else gets paid? That's it? That's your defense against, that's your checks and balances is only financial. The executive branch has no control at all over the judicial branch. Not in Missouri, because now we have this nonpartisan selection. Used to be the control was he got to pick who the next person is, but he has to take one of the three they're submitted by this ridiculous process. That's how it works. It's nonsensical. So these consequences of employees misusing their authority are supposed to be judged by these people. So the standards do not depend upon whether we like the official. The standards are supposed to be standards across the board, right? It's not supposed to depend on a political policy or depend upon whether the person being investigated is popular, unpopular, connected. This is criminal too. Connected, isolated, respectable, or controversial. The standard is supposed to be the same for all of those types of people, but it's not. If you piss somebody off politically, tell you what, they're going to come guns blazing and take you out. That's what they do. They do it in the United States, they do it in Missouri, and they do it elsewhere. So today we're going to look at several national stories involving surveillance, correctional system abuse, public record obstruction, qualified immunity, prosecutorial misconduct, and the removal effort directed at an elected Missouri prosecutor. I haven't followed up on that, and I meant to the last couple of weeks. So it's not that every official is corrupt. That's not what we're saying. It is that unchecked power produces predictable dangers. You know, if your power is not checked, if somebody doesn't question you, all you're going to do is increase your power. That's how it works. The public has the right to ask who made the decision. What evidence is there to support that decision? What records were created as a result of that? Because that's the only check and balance you got, because the judicial branch has no check at all, you know, except the funding by the legislature. What are they supposed to do, right? They investigate themselves if that ever happens. Oh, yeah, we're the only ones. We're so glorious that we investigate ourselves, right? We don't need an executive branch investigation of a lawyer. We need to control that from start to finish. You know, if the Missouri bar was subject to the executive branch in any way, or if the investigation didn't include the judicial branch anyway, then it might be something with a check and balance. But you don't have that in the practice of law, right? And it's hard to say that you have it in any other space, but at least there's the pretense that the judicial branch can at least say some things about a different licensing process. They can actually make a ruling that matters. They won't do it in the realm of lawyer licensing. They just will ignore it completely and just say, what other profession, think about this, what other profession could you apply for a license, send it out, have it wait for 2 years, 2.5 years, without question, without comment, with nothing, when a standard lawyer, you know, when they're just coming into out of law school or whatever, it doesn't take more than 3-4 months, right? But you can wait for 2.5 years. Imagine if you did that in any other profession. If you were, you went to the schools, did everything you could to get a real estate license, to go through all the work, turn in all your application, and they say, okay, we'll get back with you. And you waited 2.5 years. What do you think would happen? Somebody would sue, right? So, but in the practice of law, if you do that, the Supreme Court just says, that's okay. You know, you can wait 2.5 years. You can wait 18 months. You can wait, well, you know, till we say so. Why? Because there's no checks and balances. If that was done by the executive branch, as it is for realtors or for anybody else with a license that they are not controlled, but they're supervised all the way up to the governor. Arguably, the executive branch controls all those licensing processes. And if any one of those waited 2.5 years to give an answer to anything, the Supreme Court had friggin' come unglued. Of course they would. You saying that, no, you executive branch, get your asses moving. You can't wait 2.5 years to give an answer. And then there's a further one. The Supreme Court themselves are guilty of this. If they don't want you to have a license, they don't have to say why. They don't have to say why. They answer it with one word. How can you take all the Supreme Court justices, put them in a room, and have them say yes or no? That's it. Yes, and all of them say no, right? We're not going to let this person in. And we don't have to say why. Why? Because we have all the power and we have zero checks and balances. And so we can make him wait 2.5 years. First, we can make him wait 18 months. Then we can make him wait 2.5 years. And then we just get to call him a criminal the rest of his life. You know, that's me. There's several others like me, by the way. I'm not alone. But that's how they do it. And I believe that's just downright wrong. But it starts with these shadowy processes and taking things that you don't have the power to do, but they let you do it anyway, and then using those shadowy processes to stop something. And that's what's going on in the lawsuit, in particular with the ATC. Because ATC gets, and if you don't understand this, you need to. Because this is it's just wrong what they're doing. They go out and they go to a liquor license place. They walk in the door. They and this it's in a couple of three different areas of the law, by the way. I already told you the story about lewdness, you know, several months ago, but maybe it warrants bringing it up again, where they get to go out and they say to a liquor license holder on the spot, hey, why don't you get rid of this patron because we can see pubic hair. And if you don't, we're going to take your license. We're going to take your license because that's lewdness. Now, one person came in, described what was there, took action on the lewdness. Now, lewdness is something that is generally would cause a nuisance sort of procedure initiated by the sheriff. In Chapter 311, it says, you know, by the sheriff, by the prosecutor of the county, or by eight citizens to get to go in and say this is some kind of a nuisance. But you can skip all of that if you just make a checklist and some guy comes in and says that's lewd and that is therefore against the law. And that means you, owner of the bar that has and maintains the liquor license, you are allowing criminal and lewd behavior, and that is against the law, and so therefore we can take your license. Does that make sense? And they do the same thing with these machines. It's a one person, accuser, prosecutor, decision maker, like jury and judge, and then sentence, you know, that gives you the sentence, right? And so some agent for liquor licenses goes into a bar, sees a machine on the countertop that looks like a machine game, you know, a digital game of some sort. And he decides that is against the law. Okay, now he's not a policeman. He's not even a law enforcement officer. He holds the, most of them anyway, I think all of them actually at this point, holds a post certification, and then he gets to go out and say, this machine is illegal. Now, first of all, how the hell does he know that? You know, he doesn't know that except through some declaration of Catherine Hanaway that, well, I've decided they're all illegal, and so there is no gray area. They're all illegal. Screw it. The judge ruled a couple of particular ones illegal. I say they all are, and that this area is over. And she's been doing that for months, right? And so that's what she gets to do. And now that transmutes down to some flunky liquor license agent down below who gets to come out and say, well, Catherine Hanaway said they're all illegal, and tell the person on the spot, you don't remove this machine, I'm taking your liquor license because those are illegal. But who makes the determination that something is illegal? It's not that agent. If you had a felony of some sort, fine, you'd never get a liquor license in the first place. If you get charged with a felony, they probably could take action against you too. But you can't just do it based on an accusation, an instant accusation, prosecution, decision-making, and sentencing all in one with a guy that walks in and says, this is what we're doing. That is what we're fighting at Moleg. That BS sort of process where you get to say, well, this is illegal, you're a criminal, and therefore we're going to take your license. You are a criminal. You're not a criminal if you take the machine out, but we get to decide that you're a criminal. You don't get to make that decision. Only a jury of my peers, after a jury trial beyond a reasonable doubt, gets to determine that I'm a criminal. That's the process we're fighting. Okay, and that's a BS process. It's just nuts. It's the exact same thing as that happened to me, you know. It's the same thing. So what happens when government gets it wrong, which they often do? Most of the time, nothing. And that's depressing because we think something should happen. And who knows if we're going to be successful on this or not. I think we have a strong a strong possibility of we have plenty of people who were damaged by this process and damaged by other processes and targeted enforcement. We've got plenty of that. And so how does the AG fight it? They attack me. Was that Sam Trapp just doesn't like the AG. I don't even know her. I don't give a rip about her. I give a rip about how she makes decisions, though. I don't know her. I don't have anything against her. She's probably a nice person. Good for her. I'm a nice person, too. Reasonable minds and reasonable people can disagree. But you don't take a legal question and answer it by changing the subject. The legal question is out there. How do you answer it? You attack Samuel Trapp. What? Makes no sense at all. Oh, look, squirrel. Let's go over there. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. You've got bigger problems. Oh, my God. Sam Trapp is speaking out. What are we going to do? It's nuts. So anyway, I wanted to follow a couple of things. We're going to get to the Ray County prosecutor case today. We're going to get to a couple of those things that the AG is doing. But we also have some other like flock cameras. Have you heard about? And now there was a video of it. My sister put me onto this, actually, because she was watching the video. I've not watched the video yet. But that video has created quite a set of drama. These guys have made tens of millions of dollars, probably more. I don't remember the action, but it's millions and millions and millions that these flock guys have been making. And there was a video that went out that some investigator went up, and he did quite a bit of work. And I saw the premise of it, so it's crazy. Let's go to the surveillance state and tell you a little bit about what's happened there. Flock safety announced additional safeguards now. Now they're saying, oh, geez, we have to safeguard it ourselves for its license plate reader systems. Those changes include, reportedly, shorter default retention periods. They're holding stuff for a long time and then going back and doing unauthorized search warrants, if you want to even call them search warrants, unauthorized searches that they are just going back and doing it. And at willy-nilly, individual officers can go back and search all these things or request all this stuff or search it at their leisure when they feel like it. That's nuts. Well, without a warrant, they're tracking their girlfriends, their prior wives, seeing where they're hanging out and using the system because how do you say this nicely? You can't really blame them because they're just government employees that, are doing their thing. Oh, by the way, I won't tell you that's probably bad form, so I won't do it. But he deserves it if I did, and I'll just leave it out. But Flock now has announced it's new. Now it has an additional safeguard. Oh, geez. Why didn't you think of the safeguards before you put this in? You know people are going to abuse it. You absolutely know. Just because they're law enforcement, we're law enforcement. So you can't say police officer anymore. You better say law enforcement. You better have some SWAT gear on. You better have full tactical gear, even if you're just a guy standing on a street corner or a school resource officer. You better put them in something. Jesus, it's a war zone everywhere. Watch out for that. We got to put them in a war zone and gear them up for that. Because it's all about enforcement, remember? But the changes include shorter default retention periods because they were holding it for a long period of time. And supposedly they're shortening that up. Case code requirement. So they're trying to put a requirement in that you have to access which case you're referring to before you get to search. Controls on allowable search and auditing for abnormal search activity. At the same time, more than 50 jurisdictions have canceled, suspended, rejected, or deactivated Flock systems this year during 2026. So the concern isn't simply that cameras exist. The concern is that thousands of the cameras can be combined into a searchable record of where people travel, who they visit, where they worship, where they receive medical treatment, where they attend a political event, and where they spend the night. That's some scary shit, pardon my French. Supporters could make a legitimate point. License plate readers can help locate a stolen car, identify maybe a suspect, and solve a crime. But effectiveness doesn't resolve legality. I remember a Supreme Court case from law school and beyond. I don't remember the case itself, but the question was, would you take the risk of letting one criminal get away with it, or at the expense of having somebody, some innocent people, get punished that shouldn't have? And the response has always been, well, at least among reasonable people, is that, well, no. You know, if one criminal gets away with it, okay, but the process has to be protected. And the process itself. These people don't want to talk about processes. All they want to talk about are the bad guys. We're the good guys. They're the bad guys. Why are we the good guys? Because we have a badge. Oh, really? You know, that badge means you're a good guy? I don't think so. We got some stories about that, if you'd like to hear about it. And I'm not saying all of them. 90% of the time, that's true. But, you know, they're good guys. They're into it for the right reason, or at least they started it for the right reason, just like a politician. But it's hard to get rid of the power that you're used to having. And some of them don't do a will without that power. And they can't not show you how powerful they are. So, and the same thing goes with flock cameras. You know, you can't just say, oh, these cameras exist, and so therefore they're safe. You know, thousands can be combined to do danger, you know, to track people. And, you know, what tool, you know, any tool can be useful, but still should require strict control. A gun, carrying a gun on the job, is probably pretty useful for a law enforcement guy. You know, when somebody ups the threat, you got to be able to defend yourself, and I'm all for that. But there still should be strict controls. When did you fire? How did you fire? How many rounds did you fire? You know, how do you justify each and every round? You know, those things are controls. So the correct question shouldn't be, have these cameras ever solved a crime? I'm sure they have. The correct question should be, who can search the system? For what purpose? Must the officer enter a real case number? Is the purpose of the search recorded? Is there a warrant requirement? How long is that information retained? What outside agency or private company can access it? That's an important one. Can immigration agencies search it willy-nilly to go find people? You know, without a warrant, I mean. And I don't know. I don't know where I stand on that. You know, and by the way, all I want to do is make sure that people aren't abusing it. You know, the local sheriff isn't selling your data to one of your enemies. You know, can an officer search for a former spouse, a romantic partner, find out what she's doing or he's doing, a political critic, a neighbor, a journalist, you know, hunt people down? Who reviews? And is there even a review process for reviewing a search or the searches that have occurred? Is there some kind of review? Is it subject to, remember they were putting those citizen advisory panels together, or citizen advisory board, sometimes they called them CAPs, sometimes CABs, that would review what the police are doing. Maybe with flock cameras, that should be a something that's required. Because I'm not necessarily against a camera. I'm against a camera being used to track regular people who have nothing to do with it, or keeping it around as a substitute for police work. You know, what? They don't have to do police work anymore because they got a camera? That's a valid tool, but it should only be used when they have, you know, that shouldn't be used to create the probable cause. You should have the probable cause to create the search, and through that, enough to get a warrant before you search where the people are. And you should at least have to outline it to somebody. So who reviews suspicious searches is important to me. And what punishment would be fitting for a person who personally misuses the camera, anything like that. You know what? Look at this. Here, I'm perfectly right. Just now on the Hill, DC Now, the TV's showing. You know, we got 8, 10 TV screens in here. One of the headlines across the bottom said, new limitations for flock cameras. New limitations put out. Said, here's what you got to do. And, you know, I'm for all that. So there's been plenty of alleged personal misuse of these license plate systems. A national compilation identified at least 28 reported cases involving law enforcement database or automatic license plate reader misuse. At least 14 of those, or half, reportedly were officers involved in romantic interests and they were spying on their significant other. One example involved Brentwood, Missouri, where an investigation reportedly sustained policy violations against an officer accused of using flock searches involving his former wife during a divorce action, right? In Habersham County, Georgia, a deputy was reportedly fired and later arrested after an audit of the system revealed searches involving looking for his romantic partner. In Sumpter County, Florida, a detective was fired and criminally charged over searches involving her husband's former wife. So she's on there investigating her husband's former wife. These matters are not all at the same procedural stage. We're working on it, and I might get some information on it. Some of them involve internal findings from agencies that actually did the things themselves. Some of them involve termination of the people who were stretching their power, let's say. Some involved criminal charges. They shouldn't all be described as a conviction. They're not, you know, but they're in various processes. But collectively, they do answer one common argument. People are often told that only criminals need to fear surveillance. The ex-wife might not be a criminal. You know, the girlfriend might not be a criminal. But that's, you know, if you... The problem is the abuse of power and using that system to go and search. These are powerful databases, powerful. Connect the dots. There are thousands of cameras all over the country. They can follow you across the country with your license plate reader. I disagree with that concept completely. I'm just offended by it. I do realize the world's changing, and they're going to be able to see you anywhere you go, face recognition and all this stuff. These are creating big issues. But when do you push back? After it's too late or as the systems are being built? I don't know. I'd rather live on an island where there's no damn cameras following me all over the place. And, if I could have buy my own island, I probably would. But you wonder how long it's going to go on. You got Elon Musk with cameras on his satellites that can read the date off a dime on the ground far below. Maybe they could still track you, you know, just with all that. I don't know. It's a common argument, though. People are told only criminals have to fear surveillance. Really? Is that right? I don't know if I'd want an old girlfriend, you know, finding out wherever I went, you know, not that I really would care, but depends on who's looking for me, you know. I don't, whether I'd be for or against it, I'd just at least like to know it's not through some system that they're using that they shouldn't be, you know. So these cases suggest that the danger of search and of overreach might come from authorized employees who use a legitimate access for an illegitimate purpose. And it doesn't require a hacker. All it requires is somebody with a password. So what should the local government, you know, the people who use these flock cameras, be required to disclose? I don't know. Every operator in my, you know, a list of quick ones off the top of my head, every agency operating or permitted to use these things should maintain and produce a list of all employees with access a list of any outside agency permitted to access their local system, whether they're being shared is what I mean. If they're being shared outside of Missouri, if they're being shared across the state, I'm not sure how I feel about that. You know, if these cameras are used to like the ones that are in Camden County, if they're only used by the sheriff's office in Camden County and not for a statewide tracking system, which I doubt, I think that here we have a statewide tracking system. At least the cameras can be accessed. I mean, geez, why wouldn't the highway patrol be able to access them and follow people all over the state? But, you know, should a county deputy be able to follow someone all the way across state or only in his own jurisdiction? I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. I might have to put some thought into that before I said something. So, but I still would like a list of all employees that do have access, a list of all the outside agencies that can access the local system, and a stated purpose and a case number field for each search. That's apparently what they're trying to get done in Flock right now. An audit report. I want an audit. I want to, you know, who searched for what each day. You know, a policy violation finding, like if somebody is there. What are the retention settings? How long are these things kept? They shouldn't be kept forever. And then maybe right now the big thing nationally is about immigration. I guess the Trump administration and the ICE people are able to access these flocks across the country trying to find people and their cars and anybody who... you know, they've had some pretty good success with this. So there's some federal actions that are going regarding this and using these to find people that would otherwise not be able to be located. And so they're doing it warrantless is my thought. Is my knowledge on that. And then it depends on where they go. So imagine an ICE guy from Washington, D.C. calls up your local sheriff here and says, you got some of them flock cameras? And he goes, yeah, can you give me access or run a search for this thing? Because we had a guy that we believe left Florida and he's hanging out in Missouri. And he's a guy we're looking from ICE. Can you find out if he's there? And the officer, oh, sure. Well, they just want to communicate. There's interdepartmental cooperation and blah, blah, blah. So we'll go look for him. Yeah, we found him. He's hanging out on, you know, whatever, moved in with some girl. Here's his car. We know where his car is. Is that legal? I don't know. It depends on how you look at it, you know. Where's the warrant? Why is it that an ICE guy could call? And apparently this is some of the ways that things are happening, is that they're using the Flock nationwide system to follow people between jurisdictions and stuff like that. And I'm not so sure how I feel about that. You know, I'm sure the FBI would have procedures for how they would follow it. You know, the national sort of criminal activity should be able, you know, how they go follow it. And they should have to get a warrant for that purpose and not just use it and then get a warrant with information based on that tool. I would think that the warrant should come first and then the search. And how do you get that warrant if you don't have probable cause? If it is an overstay enough to give you probable cause of a visa, I mean. I've been here too long. My coffee's gone cold already. Huntington, West Virginia. The ACLU filed a lawsuit challenging the process used by Huntington, the city, to approve a $2.1 million surveillance camera contract. The city council reportedly approved the contract by a vote of 6-4 after a lengthy meeting where more than 50 people spoke, nearly all in opposition. This is a lawsuit concerning procurement and public process. It was not, at the time, described a final ruling that Flock was unconstitutional. So the question is, in that case, was whether a local government followed the law when it committed public funds and approved a major surveillance system. Los Angeles, the LA Police Department allowed its Flock contract to expire while citing serious privacy and civil liberty concerns. That doesn't say that every use of Flock is unlawful, but it does demonstrate that a major police department has considered the risks and say they are substantial enough to step away from monitoring everybody all the time. Columbus, Ohio. The mayor of Columbus directed police to stop statewide sharing of Flock camera data following an audit. So again, it's not necessarily the existence of the camera at one intersection. It's the transformation of the local separate system into a broad, interconnected, everywhere surveillance network. And so, I don't know, there's some governing principles that are beginning to develop, and this is a good thing. Every search should require a legitimate case number, a recorded investigative purpose, a durable audit trail, a reasonable retention limit, some kind of independent review through a cap or a cab, anything, and real punishment if there's personal use. Without those protections, the system doesn't merely watch criminals or help you find a person involved in a hit and run. It watches anybody and then relies on some kind of internal restraint or lack thereof to prevent or create mistakes. So history tells us that internal restraint, especially of government worker, and especially without any oversight, is just not enough. And so I think there should be other ways of guaranteeing that. We're going to go back because I'm going to take a break here and go heat up my coffee. I'm going to put it in the nuker and then come back. And we're going to play the song that I set up for you. This is old. I remember my sister, she's probably going to get mad at me for this, when we were kids, listening to this song and crying. Yes, I remember. And here it comes. Cry away, oh sister of mine.
Goodbye to you, my trusted friend. We've known each other since we were 9 or 10. Together we've climbed hills and trees, learned of love and ABC, and skinned our hearts and skinned our knees. Goodbye, my friend, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that the spring is in the air, pretty girls are everywhere. Think of me and I'll be there. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun. But the hills that we climbed were just seasons out of time. Goodbye, Papa, please pray for me. I was the black sheep of the family. You tried to teach me right from wrong. Too much wine and too much song. Wonder how I got along. Goodbye, Papa, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that the spring is in the air, little children everywhere, when you see them I'll be there. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun. But the wine and the song, like the seasons have all gone. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun. Michelle, my little one, you gave me love and helped me find the sun. And every time that I was down, you would always come around and get my feet back on the ground. Goodbye, Michelle, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that in the air, with the flowers everywhere, I wish that we could both be there. We had joy, we had had seasons in the sun, but the stars we could reach put your starfish on the beach. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun, but the stars we could reach put your starfish on the beach. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun, but the wine and the song, like the seasons, have all gone.
There you have it. Well, I hope the crying is over. Get your tissues thrown away. Get some new ones. There won't be any more crying today. Let's see. I wanted to go back, not on the flock part. We were looking at a week or two ago, this Ray County prosecutor thing. And, you know, authority isn't the same as proof. Is, you know, the allegations, when I read them against this prosecutor, his local prosecutor by the Missouri Attorney General's office, basically is, she's sleeping with everybody. And that's bad, you know. You got a little tiny town you live in. And if you're single, I guarantee you they're rotating through the available crew. Even if you're not single, people rotate through the available crew of available sexual partners. You know, in a small town, you gonna tell me that people don't, you know, each pass each other off? It's depressingly true. If you know, you're not willing to move to a place with more people, there's just not enough people to go around. But anyway, I'm not saying it's okay. I don't care. I don't know the allegations. I do know the allegations, but I don't know the truth of it one way or the other. I just remember reading it and going, okay, you think that people in bigger cities aren't in legal communities aren't swapping around? I got news for you. They are. And that's how it works. So this is the case of the state of Missouri versus Camille Johnston and the elected prosecutor of Ray County. The procedural status is this. A quo warranto was filed on July the 16th. The first judge recused himself, and Judge Dean Darren Lee Adkins was assigned, and a preliminary order was issued the same day. Johnston later appeared through counsel. She filed her answer in an exhibit on July 26 and moved to restrict public commentary by counsel, meaning AG's office. They like to get on and talk about all the beautiful things they're doing around the world, regardless of the fact that there are other opposing opinions. Your opinion only matters if you're the attorney general, right? Your opinion counts because you were appointed. Anybody else's opinion doesn't, so you get to get out and talk about what this prosecutor allegedly did quite vocally and put it all out there for the world to see, and that is the point. Destroying someone, at least in my view, destroying someone publicly and through the media before you destroy them in court. Hopefully they'll just capitulate and be done, and that's what it looked like to me. And discovery appeared on the docket on July the 27th. As of August 14, the case is not disposed, and so it hasn't reached any sort of final judgment on the merits. The attorney general's office may describe its action as removing the prosecutor, but the legal mechanism is a court proceeding. The attorney general initiates it, but the court process is the adjudicative authority, and that distinction matters. But the state alleges, you know, its allegations concerning workplace treatment, personal relationships, she's sleeping around with a bunch of different people, that may have created conflicts, A relationship involving a prospective defendant and assistance given to a man accused of sexual assault who later absconded. And Johnston disputes the state's case. But you won't hear about that. You only hear the massive news on this from the AG's office. These are serious accusations, but they're only accusations unless and until they're supported by admissible evidence and adjudicated through a very fair process. And sure, the Attorney General has the power to file this suit. I wonder whether she should have. Missouri law does provide a quo warranto process through which the AG can ask a court to remove a public official. Missouri precedent recognizes that elected prosecutors may be subject to such proceedings. So, she's got the power. But the speed, the proof, the scope, and the proportionality, I worry about. She took out in one day an elected prosecutor and they displaced her through an extraordinary interim relief before any complete merits hearing, before an answer was even filed, and before the public had seen any sort of adjudication of the facts. Such processes I don't like because I already know what they do to people without any sort of oversight. They attack them. That's how it works. And so the process is what needs some scrutiny. Now, the state's going to come out there and claim that, oh, this isn't about policing any sort of private morality on our part. You know, if prosecutors want to sleep around, let them. And we're not against that. Why would you be? It's they were going to argue that a personal relationship is only relevant because they allegedly affected a prosecutorial decision, any sort of recusal, any sort of office management, or the treatment of employees or assistance given to a criminal suspect. This is internal office BS is what this is. I would almost bet you, and I don't know, that there's a lower attorney somewhere in the or employee of some sort in the prosecutor's office who called and got this all jazzed up. I'd love to see that. And where's the oversight, or will there be any? Hopefully the oversight's what's going on in the judicial branch. And, this lady has an attorney. I think I object just in principle to being able to remove a person based on an allegation. You know, the state, it's still just an allegation. You know, it's just, I have that. That is what you can always count on from me. It's always about the process, not about the personality involved. And, I don't care. This lady might be the Antichrist and the AG might be. I don't know. I don't get to choose between that. But the process should protect them both and not be able to use as a battering ram by one side or the other. And sure, they're the government. But you think the government is always acting properly? If they were, then Hanaway wouldn't be making allegations against another department of government in a different location, you know. And if you're looking for Hanaway to be non-deferential or I don't know what non, I'd like her to be far objective. I don't believe she is from what I've seen so far. It seems pretty lopsided, you know, in the things that I've seen. And but I don't know. She might be an objective person. Who knows? But the state contends or will say that an elected prosecutor occupies a position of public trust and cannot use a personal relationship to influence the administration of justice. Yeah, but that presumes some kind of a influence on the administration of justice. And what if we took that same sentence and applied it to the AG in relationship to creating a hunt scenario to go out and hunt for certain types of crime, if you're going to allege it's crime, without even saying that it's a crime up front, with nothing more than a particular set of devices, for example. So the state is also going to say, that, and they already did, that the risk of ongoing harm would justify the immediate intervention rather than waiting for the ordinary litigation to run its course. I don't know. I say the voters elected and selected this prosecutor. And you've been able to come in an hour, get rid of her. I'm not for. And there should be some sort of oversight. Not just you going in and convincing a judge. Who knows about, you know, where that judge is in the nonpartisan judicial selection process. I mean, who knows? Removing or suspending an elected official before some kind of evidentiary adjudication isn't a routine employment decision, and it temporarily over, at least, well, semi-permanently, possibly, overrides an election. And I don't like that. That doesn't mean elected officials are above the law. It means that the burden of proof, a procedural protection, any sort of public explanation should reflect the seriousness of the remedy, right? The government shouldn't be permitted to transform some sort of petition or press release or affidavit into a final public verdict. The public deserves to see the allegations, an answer, the evidence, any sort of preliminary order or discovery, and you know, somebody participate in that final ruling. So I don't know. I don't mean to say that everybody has personal relationships and therefore, you know, who she's given it up to doesn't matter. Maybe it does matter. But a private relationship should not be treated as governmental business. They become relevant when they affect official decisions, I suppose, or create an undisclosed conflict, produce some sort of favoritism, enable some kind of retaliation, or assist a person accused of a crime. But the real issue isn't whether the prosecutor had this relationship. The issue is whether that relationship altered the lawful performance of public duties. How is there a current threat that this is going to continue? If she assisted someone and they escaped, that's already occurred. If she's given deferential treatment to a sex partner who happened to be an opposing counsel, now that everybody knows about it, surely it won't continue. So you've removed those sort of things. I don't know that it's an immediate threat once you do that. And once the judges know in that certain jurisdiction, they're not going to allow it to continue anyway. Or once there's even a hint that this is going to go on. But I believe the publicity was more important than making sure that people get treated fairly. That's typically the case. I don't know. Before having a confident conclusion, the public should see the complete preliminary order, any affidavits or evidence submitted in support of this emergency relief, any record concerning recusals, the charging or non-charging decisions allegedly affected by these personal relationships, the communications involving the accused person who allegedly was allowed to abscond, any record concerning these workplace complaint, and I'd like to know how this particular complaint was placed before Catherine Hanaway. That's what I want to know. And I do want to see, you know, any discovery, you know, if it was me, I'd want to see any and all of this. So I don't know. If you had any verified evidence that Johnston knowingly used her office to help a criminal escape, that's not good for her. But that's something that it, once you know about it, you know, you can make the decision whether you're going to vote for her in the future or not. And I don't know. I don't know her. Don't know the AG. But I don't like how this was immediately done. But I don't like that anyway. I have a general propensity to have a much fairer process. And you don't get to destroy people by public opinion, you know, you put out there. I don't like that. So I suppose it's not that the attorney general lacked legal authority. She had the authority. This is an extraordinary remedy to remove somebody from office, an elected prosecutor. There better be something far more, I don't know, removing an elected prosecutor before a full merits hearing is an extraordinary act, and the public deserves the petition, the answer, the evidence, and the eventual ruling, not trial by press release. And that seems to be going around. You issue a press release and suddenly everybody's a criminal. I don't like it. I don't like that. It's and you may or may not. I mean, you might like it that way, that accusation is enough for you. I don't think so. Newly disclosed court materials reportedly describe a broad undercover surveillance operation involving progressive organizations, labor unions, protesters, and political activity in Minnesota, right? Law enforcement may investigate actual threats, planned violence, or specific crimes, but the First Amendment does not permit the government to treat a lawful association, a protest, evidence of union activity, journalism, or political disagreement as sufficient evidence of criminality. I've been bitching about this ever since long time, forever, but very much so during the Trump days, because the using the government as your personal weapon has been prevalent of late. You know, the public needs to answer quite a few questions on this particular investigation. Did investigators possess individual grounds concerning particular suspected crimes in Minnesota? Were lawful organizations monitored because of their political positions? How long has the collected information been retained? I don't know. It comes into effect on a bunch of different fronts, and I don't know. I'm not. Minnesota's been targeted for a while because of you know, the high level of immigration up there from the certain communities. And the Trump administration has been using these surveillance platforms, allegedly, to hunt down the politics of it all, the ICE nature of it all, and collect and pick up people. These are the type of investigations that I really don't like, at least not without something more, warrant, something additional. So I think I'm going to do one. I might still be able to do two segments. I've still got plenty of stuff to go through, but I wanted to talk about the Here's another one. You want to talk about government abuse. And when I practiced law years ago, I did quite a few cases on this particular theme and topic. And so it's particularly disgusting to me that this occurs. And the fact is, it's still occurring in places. And it's hard to these people get away with it all the time, and because it's happening to criminals. You get, if you just allege somebody's a criminal, suddenly, oh well, suddenly nobody's supposed to care that they're being abused. Okay, I've never felt that way, never. And so this segment has to do with California women's prisons. And there was a federal investigation and some systemic findings, and they just came out. On August 13, the U.S. DOJ announced findings concerning women's prison. And it's not merely a private complaint filed by one prisoner. According to the working draft, the Justice Department has concluded that California's prison system systematically fails to protect incarcerated women from staff sexual abuse and harassment. Well, Missouri, you know, I filed several on that topic, federal suits, and I'd say, you know, that there's a propensity for that kind of thing in the system anyway. These are the women that can't speak for themselves. They're always, you know how the AG's office always defended it. Oh, well, these girls are criminals. They're basically hookers anyway. They're basically less than anyway, because they're in jail. And if they wish to trade sex to get a pack of cigarettes, well, How can you blame the officer? Oh, I see. The officer, the poor officer, you know, this is how they always defend it. Always. The women are the bad guy and not the men who are using them as their own personal harems for a little bit of cigarettes, you know, or a higher paying job in the laundry, you know, and so they can get, the way the girls explained it to me was, yeah, you want that money, especially you don't have anybody sending you money for commissary every month, because otherwise you get the state issued tampons. And I was like, all right, it's all I need to know. If you want to buy the good tampons, well, you got to give it up to the laundry manager so that you could get a higher paying inside the prison job that'll pay you $30 a month instead of five, you know. And so that way you have a little bit of money on your commissary so you can get the higher dollar. And so you're more comfortable during your woman's periods. And I don't know. It's terrible. Terrible, but the state, their attorney general's office always like, well, yeah, but these are bad people. Oh, so they're bad. It's the standard argument. Bad people, bad people, bad people. We're the good guys. We're the good people. And even if the jail guard is acting outside the way, so he's not to blame. It's these terrible girls out there saying, you know, I'll give it up to you if you give me some cigarettes. It's their fault. It's their deal. And somehow it's now way back when they had started, you know, had changed the law to turn it into a crime for that kind of thing to happen. But they don't prosecute them. They never prosecute them. They know they have to defend them because somebody will sue. And then when they defend them, they instantly turn a very strong supporter of the poor guy who was just doing his job, and these bad girls, sucked him in. That's how they defend it. And apparently in California, they've discovered something similar. At least the Justice Department. Investigators describe unsafe reporting procedures, high risk of retaliation. You know, they lose their laundry job. They get put in the bad part of the jail. They might not get any sort of special, and I don't want to say special treatment, but better treatment that they were somehow getting before. They won't get it anymore. They'll start being disciplined, that kind of thing. And then there are situations in which complaints are handled by the very personnel implicated in the misconduct. So you make a complaint against the laundry guy, and the laundry guy is the guy that investigates the complaint. How's that going to pan out for you, do you think? Investigators with the DOJ described unsafe procedures all the way around. California, for its part, says there's a zero tolerance policy and we have our own independent audits but a written zero tolerance policy isn't the same as an effective reporting system. You can say we have a zero tolerance policy, we don't put up with it, but if people aren't allowed to report it, or if that's reported and investigated by the very guy investigating it, they're never going to come to the conclusion that, you know, what happened shouldn't have happened, and they're going to treat the zero tolerance guy and get rid of him, right? So a policy is only meaningful when a prisoner can report misconduct safely, confidently, and without retaliation. The federal government gave California 49 days, allegedly, to begin remediation or face litigation. So the central question is this: what good is a zero tolerance policy when the persons reporting abuse have to rely on the same institution and sometimes the same chain of command connected to the alleged abuse? This isn't about one bad employee. It concerns institutional design. I remember when I was doing one of these cases before, it came out in my investigation of a jail, women's jail in Missouri, that they didn't even have a simple policy whereby one male guard couldn't be alone with one female inmate ever. That makes sense, doesn't it? And they're going to say, oh, gee, we'd have to have too many people in the jail. No, you just have to better manage those that are in the jail and say, you know, there should either be quite a few inmates so that one doesn't get targeted, or put it the other way around. So the officer, the male officer, doesn't get solicited by the girl. Oh, gee, give me some cigarettes and I'll give you some nookie. And, I can't resist that. Here, have some cigarettes. You know, that wouldn't happen if you had more than one person in the room, right? Or if you're going to escort one woman, have it be done by a female guard, something like that. And it turned out that there was no policy against allowing a male. Maybe you could have all female guards in a female prison. I don't know if that's, you know, legality of that would be questioned, but you got to have some sort of protective measures, and they didn't exist. So these are about institutional designs and how that works. So who receives the complaint, who preserves the evidence after the complaint, who would be assigned, or if there's any sort of protections of the complaining party. More importantly, who gets to decide whether an accusation is credible or not? Is there any sort of investigation of retaliation? And who reviews the investigators? And what happens when the accused person works inside the same institution that controls the witnesses, records, housing assignments, privileges, and discipline? That is what the federal investigation is checking into. And you could say that they're independent. And so this is why independent reporting mechanisms matter than internal policies. We have a zero tolerance policy. That's your answer? That's it? I don't know. Several other cases show different forms of correctional misconduct and accountability. A former San Diego County deputy was sentenced. He got a 57-month federal sentence after being convicted of violating detainees' civil rights. The detainee was restrained when he was pushed headfirst, resulting in a spinal injury. And it also involved a medical response and a false report stating that no force had been used. So this guy was convicted and sentenced. This isn't merely an allegation. The case demonstrates that an incident can produce separate accountability issues: the original use of force, the failure to obtain prompt medical assistance, the accuracy of official reporting, and the conduct of other employees who witnessed the event. Apparently it was there were quite a few allegations of misconduct, and this one guy got sentenced. But other people saw it, and they didn't really do a whole lot about it. So an unlawful act becomes an institutional failure when other employees protect it through silence or false documentation or misdirection, those sorts of things. That does occur. In Illinois, an Illinois correction officer and lieutenant pleaded guilty to federal civil rights violations involving the treatment of a restrained prisoner. The employee is a guy, there's two of them, Craig Muhs, M-U-H-S, and Ethan Yates. Prosecutors describe a beating, a pepper spray directed toward the prisoner's genitals, water poured over a spit hood, serious injury, failure to intervene by one against the other, delayed medical care, and inaccurate reporting. Because guilty pleas were entered, this also isn't an unresolved accusation, but the broad issue is how one assault can require several people to fail simultaneously. One person uses force, the other person didn't stop it, another one failed to report it, and one writes or accepts an inaccurate record regarding the other, another person delays medical treatment, and a culture of abuse survives through collective participation or institutional silence. In Pennsylvania, another correction officer was sentenced. Former Pennsylvania correction officer Christina Miller was sentenced to 22 to 44 months after pleading guilty to offenses involving sexual relationships with prisoners and an identity fraud scheme using prison information. So a correctional officer cannot treat a prisoner as an ordinary romantic partner. Now, I was involved in a case once where an inmate got a woman pregnant. They had a sexual relationship, and an inmate got the woman pregnant. And he wanted, you know, custody over the, or some sort of custody of the child. And he was going to be in for a long, long time. He wanted to be able to see the child. And, you know, it's kind of hard to deny that the sexual activity occurred in that case, right? And she has to go to, you know, allegedly go to prison over that because it's a felony in the state of Missouri. At least it used to be. I'm not sure if it is anymore. But this Christina Miller pleaded guilty to offenses involving sexual relationships. And so this officer controlled discipline, privilege, movement, safety, and access to institutional resources. That power imbalance makes ordinary concepts of consent inadequate. Now, you telling me a guy in prison that hasn't had any in a long time, if confronted by a woman that, you know, wants to, you know, have a sexual relationship with him, isn't going to do it? You know, maybe it's the same for women. Who knows? You know, I'm not a woman. Couldn't tell you. But I assume it is. But, you know, the power imbalance is, you know, how, you would always say, how is there any consent? That person is incapacitated because they're not allowed to make their own decisions related to this sort of thing. The law says that you can't have that kind of thing. But I have the same question over this procedure in Pennsylvania. Why don't you have something that says you can't be alone with an inmate? Why? At least if it's male and female. A male inmate can be alone with another male inmate, and a female inmate can be alone with another a female guard can be alone with a female inmate. I don't know. I don't know what the rules are, but there ought to be some sort of protective mechanism. Then there was the South Carolina prison bribery scheme. A former South Carolina prison guard, LaWanda Atkinson, pleaded guilty in a contraband operation involving drugs, cell phones, and tobacco. Federal prosecutors, get this, described more than $550,000 in bribes. The proceeds were allegedly used to purchase an SUV, designer clothes, and cosmetic surgery. Five defendants entered guilty pleas. And this case illustrates the economics of prison contraband. The same employees assigned to stop contraband may control the most profitable access points. Kind of like, what was that movie with Stephen King wrote the book, Shawshank Redemption. Remember that? And the guy who can get it for you in the prison. And it's all a bribery scheme, you know. Look the other way and here's $10. You know, here's all the money goes through. And the officers collect all the money. Maybe even bring in the stuff. You know, here's your box of smokes, but I'm going to charge you, instead of $10, I'm going to charge you $30. You know, okay, well, now my smokes just cost a lot more than they used to. So the same employee who's supposed to stop contraband is the same guy that's making it go on. And that's what happened where they had $550,000. So when an employee can monetize access to these things, the security system itself is a business opportunity, right? There was a federal corrections officer in Florida that pleaded guilty to sexual abuse of a prisoner, accepting a bribe, and introducing contraband. This is a guilty plea, another one, not merely some sort of indictment. Sexual abuse, bribery, contraband frequently arise from the same basic conditions. An employee possesses concentrated control over people who have limited ability to report misconduct safely. You know, they're basically incapacitated. So the solution shouldn't just consist of another policy manual, or, oh, gee, we have a policy against that. There's got to be some kind of an independent reporting, some kind of outside auditing, some kind of witness protection for the people that do report, and then a meaningful prosecution. These examples tell you that they have been able to have effective procedures for dealing with them. These people were all charged and pleaded guilty, or were found guilty by the court. So I don't know. Well, what about any sort of public records? Court received public attention. Here we got something new. This isn't about jail. Administrative tribunals aren't necessarily as public, but an administrative judge can suspend someone's driver's license, revoke a professional credential, impose regulatory consequences, or make findings to destroy a person's ability to earn a living. These are important things to look at that also require serious scrutiny. So in Washington, there's a Washington Department of Licensing, a judge. Internal messages attributed to the Washington Department of Licensing, Administrative Law Judge Will Jacobson, reportedly included mocking remarks, violent jokes, and improper comments during a live case. The court later reversed this driver's license suspension that was involved, and Jacobson received a 7-day suspension. So the judge gets a 7-day suspension, can't do anything. Records reporting also identified messages using the phrase such as delete now, double delete, and do not release. The department disputes the suggestion that the judges attempted to evade public disclosure. It argues that some of the language concerned ordinary records retention practices or confidential personnel material. But that doesn't end the inquiry. The public should know whether records were deleted pursuant to a lawful retention schedule or removed to prevent disclosure. The phrase delete is not automatically proof of any sort of wrongdoing. During the surrounding process, timing and applicable retention policy and legal hold requirements, they could, whether that deletion of its own was proper. So the broader lesson is not that we shouldn't review this. It's that administrative courts exercise enormous power while often operating with less public visibility than a traditional court or tribunal. And a person can lose a license, their livelihood, or a legal right through a process most citizens would never see. Well, I have quite a few more in here, but we'll continue with them next week, and we'll talk about more qualified immunity issues and that kind of thing. But we'll review that all next week. This week, I thank you for listening to Civic Outlaws. Hope you enjoy your weekend that is upcoming, and that you listen to Civic Outlaws every Friday from 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. Central Standard Time, that you listen to International Flavor Monday through Friday from 7:30, Monday through Thursday. Sorry about that. From 7:30 to 9. And I'm trying to get back into, I tried to set it up this morning. It didn't work. I have to do something, maybe get some training from the JR element, who can teach me how to do this, because I was able to use the camera portion for my Russian speaking version of International Flavor, который называется Международный вкус, but it didn't work that way, and so I'll have to review that for next week and get it set up. But I want to go back to doing my Russian version once a week on Sundays. We'll see if I can get that set up by this Sunday. Would be entertaining. In the meantime, have a very nice mid-Missouri day, and I will plan on being here in studio next Friday for this program, and then Monday through Thursday for International Flavor. Have yourselves a very wonderful mid-Missouri day. Very hot out there. Be careful.